So this is our webinar on collecting evidence to share impact of professional learning. And I want to say that this webinar is part of a series of webinars that we have produced as part of our Every Educator is an Advocate campaign. And we're really grateful to the Charles and Lynn Schusterman Family Foundation for their support of this important advocacy work. As we get started on the conversation today, I hope that you'll all take a few moments to introduce yourself in our chat box. Please put in your name, where you're from. If you're from a particular school district, we would love to know that as well, or organization. And if you have any goals for this call or any questions that you want to be sure to have answered, please go ahead and share those as well. We will be monitoring the chat box throughout the call and want to make sure that we get to all of your questions. And I love seeing folks already engaging in the chat box, so thank you for that. I wanted to take just a moment to walk through our agenda for the next hour. I'm really excited about the conversation. We are going to begin with a federal update from John Bernstein on the President's proposed fiscal year 2021 budget and some sense of what we might be able to expect this spring. And then I'm going to introduce our panel who have agreed to join us today to share their data journey. My hope is that this conversation will spur a great discussion amongst all of you, as well as prompting some new ideas for data collection, analysis, and compilation back in your own district so that you can continue to make the case for high-quality professional learning. Here are our goals for the webinar. They may actually be in reverse order of how we plan to tackle them, but we look forward to a rich discussion today. And we also encourage you to join in this conversation beyond this webinar by tweeting or posting about what you are learning or stories from your own data journeys. Please be sure to tag Learning Forward so that we're able to hear your perspectives and stories. Now it's my pleasure to introduce John Bernstein. I know John is familiar to many of you from our webinars, from our Learning Forward annual conference. He's the person that's steadily behind the booth. And from the updates that he provides on the appropriations process and Title II. I'm especially appreciative of John's work in the fight for Title II and for the great counsel that he's provided to Learning Forward and to me over the past 3 years. So, John, thanks so much for being on the call today.
Well, thank you, Melinda, and good afternoon, everyone. From talking to you from sunny Washington, D.C., where it's middle of February and yet 50 degrees. Apparently the groundhog was correct. If it's February though, it's not just Groundhog Day we have to worry about, it's actually the kickoff of the annual funding season here. For those of you who've been paying close attention to something other than the coronavirus, budget season actually kicked off last Monday when the President released his proposed annual budget for FY 2021. As you may recall, in years past, the President has zeroed out Title IIA. And Title IIA is the program we're most concerned with. It is the large professional learning program that provides upwards of $2.1 billion annually each year to school districts and states so that they can make sure that there is good professional learning in schools so that coaches can be hired. And in some cases, about 24 states, there's a 3% set aside for principals, assistant principals, and school leaders. It's an optional set aside, so they can receive very specific professional development for themselves. This year, the President took a different angle. Rather than eliminating Title IIA outright, as he has done in his past three budgets, what he has chosen to do is to take 29 programs that support K through 12 education, including things like Title I and after school learning, and combined all of those programs into a single block grant. This block grant would then be sent down by a formula to every state. What's interesting about this is that the combined amount that he has asked for this program, all 29 programs, is actually $4.7 billion less than what these programs received in aggregate last year. So not only is Title II sort of disappear in this proposal and sort of is merged with everything else, but there's less money available for it in all of the other programs that the president proposes to consolidate. The good news for everybody on this call is that while this is something that's a little bit scary, this notion that professional learning would end up being sent down a block grant and then would have to compete in every district for attention and funding along with everything else that that these other 28 programs do. Despite all of that, do not worry. I can make very few guarantees in my job, but I'm pretty sure about 99.9% that this is not going to become the law this year. Congress simply has invested too much time and energy into reauthorizing the Every Student Succeeds Act, which Title II and these other individual lines of funding come from, and I don't believe they're prepared at this point to use this funding cycle to completely rewrite all of that and to provide less money than was provided last year. So that's good news. The second thing that seems like relatively good news this year is that we no longer have to worry about whether or not there's going to be enough money in the overall budget to pay for this. You may remember in years past we've had these arguments about how much is going to be the overall budget here because we had a Budget Control Act to worry about. Well, that is all gone. In fact, we have a set overall spending limit for the federal government already in place. That's the good news. The bad news is that this was a two-year agreement, and in the first year, the vast majority of increases in education funding were situated. This year, there's actually only about $5 billion more that they have to spend on education, labor, and health and human services, which is essentially the bill that education appears in. So $5 billion may sound like a lot of money, but it evaporates very quickly when you recognize that when the congressional appropriators fund education, they have to fund two other departments along with it in their bill. In those two departments are things like the Centers for Disease Control, the National Institutes of Health, a variety of labor programs, et cetera, et cetera. So, as I mentioned at the top, coronavirus has been a lot in the news. Well, it's probably also going to cost this government a fair amount of money that they weren't expecting to spend. That money would flow to NIH, that money would flow to CDC, and if we have a very significant outbreak, that would actually flow to Health and Human Services altogether. So they don't know how much money that's going to cost, but that could immediately take out that $5 billion. That could evaporate in a hurry. So this year, I think our goal is to essentially ignore, as I think Congress will, this proposed budget from the president. It is instead to fight for what we won last year. And for those of you who remember, we had a great year last year. For the first time in a decade, we actually received a $76 million increase for Title IIA. We had not seen any funding increase in 10 years. So that was a big win. This is the year we got to fight to keep that win. And we will be counting on all of you on this call and throughout Learning Forward's community to sort of help us do that by writing your senators and congressmen, by tweeting at them, by phone calls, and even, if possible, by personal visits, which are the things that make the most difference. So before I go, I wanted to give you a quick rundown of what's going to happen this year as a refresher for some of you. The president's kicked this off with his budget release last week. Next week is the beginning of hearings that Congress is going to have on the budget. Secretary DeVos, it was just announced, is going to testify next week on February 27th at 10 a.m. Eastern Time. I am pretty sure that that is going to be available online, and you simply have to go to the Ed Labor Committee website in order to do that, and we'll stick that into the chat. So if you find yourself with some time on your hands, or you simply at 10 a.m. next week on February 27th, or you want to watch the tape of it, you probably will hear a fair amount about what's going to happen in K through 12 education, why the department thinks that we should block grant all of these programs, and maybe hear some of our congressional supporters defend Title II and the importance of having a separate defined funding stream rather than being forced to fight it out with everyone in a giant block grant. After we have these hearings, you can expect sometime in probably late April, early May, to begin to see the first bills come out of the House and the Senate that will give us an idea of just how much money we're going to get next year. Because this is an election year, you may have heard about that. And in fact, there's an interesting debate tonight that you may want to watch to see what Michael Bloomberg has to say about education. But because this is an election year, Congress is really going to be fighting to get out of here in a hurry. They're going to be here no later than September. I think that there's a decent chance that they get our bill done by then, but there's probably also about a 40% chance that they don't, in which case we're looking at a temporary spending measure and possibly kicking final decisions on funding into maybe the next Congress and the next presidential administration. So stay tuned, stay informed, and we hope that you get involved here with Learning Forward so that we can press to keep that $76 million increase and maybe even get a little bit more.
John, thanks so much for the update and the crystal ball, sort of. So over the past 2 years, Learning Forward has engaged in a campaign called the Every Educator is an Advocate campaign. And we know that at every level and in every locale, the case needs to be made for strong professional learning. And this could be whether to a principal in order to get substitute coverage so that a teacher can go and observe a colleague in action, or to a school board member so that you can get an annual increase in a professional learning budget. The argument is stronger and easier when you have solid impact data to share. So we wanted to provide a few tips today just for getting your data into shape to be shared. The first thing that I would say is to build measurement into all of your professional learning initiatives. It's important to know where you're starting, and then think of as many ways as possible to measure what's happening in every professional learning activity you're doing, whether it's coaching, whether it's mentoring, whether it's your PLC time. What kind of data could you collect? These might be pre and post surveys. They might be pre and post lesson assessments. They could be looking at your teacher retention or your new teacher retention. There's a whole number of ideas that would really help to build your data case, and you're going to see some of those in the presentations today. Another piece that I want to mention is you don't want to get caught not when you know something is really good, but because you didn't do a baseline measure at the outset, you can't quantify for decision makers how really good it is. I've had a number of people who have said to me, it's a really awesome thing that we're doing, but we didn't know till we were in the middle of it that it was going to be as awesome as it was. So again, sort of keeping that measure early and measure often in mind is an important tool. Once you have the data, putting it into a summary document that is succinct and compelling turns it into a great advocacy tool that you can use with your principal or with your school board or with your superintendent. And these are a couple of examples that we have up on our advocacy webpage. You'll see down at the bottom of this slide the link to our data summaries library. So I invite you to visit the advocacy webpage and click on the link for data summaries to see these examples and more. And please, once you have created your data summary, share it with me so that I can continue to grow our library about effective professional learning. We are so appreciative of the education leaders who have joined us for today's webinar. They are at all different points on their data journeys, but they've agreed to share their work and then answer any questions, even the tough ones, about the work they've done and the challenges they've faced. They're thinking a lot about data, and they want you to push them, and they want to push you back to think about how best to share the story of professional learning. So I'm going to introduce them briefly now, but they're going to share their district story when they begin their presentation. And so that you know how this panel is going to work, they're each going to do a 5-minute overview of one data story from their district. And then we're going to have a discussion where all of you can ask questions, and I also have some additional questions for them. So our first speaker will be Scott Fetter. Scott is the superintendent of schools in South Brunswick, New Jersey. He's been an educational leader in New Jersey for more than 26 years. And Scott holds a special place in my heart because he joined Learning Forward for our Capitol Hill briefing this past October and has come today with a whole new data story to share. So welcome, Scott.
Oh, thank you, Melinda. Hi, everyone.
Wait, Scott, can I introduce everybody? Sorry, I should have been clear about it. Let me just introduce everybody, and then I will turn it over to you, I promise. Sarah Monaco is an assistant superintendent for Smithfield Public Schools in Rhode Island. Among her many responsibilities, Sarah leads the district's curriculum development in alignment with the state's approved standards. She's also a leader in Learning Forward's What Matters Now network, and she will be sharing some of that work today. Godfrey Rangasamy serves as the K-12 science supervisor for Prince George's County Public Schools in Maryland. Godfrey has been a science educator and leader for more than 32 years, and he also serves as a leader in Learning Forward's What Matters Now network. And Godfrey, I'll give you a heads up that you have a proud product of Prince George's County Public Schools, who's one of the listeners today, who's now the director for research and evaluation in Leander, outside of Austin, Texas. So you have a fan. And then finally, Chad Sutton. Chad is the deputy superintendent for North Kansas City Schools. In this role, he oversees principals, assistant principals, and overall pre-K-12 instruction for the district. Chad has been part of the North Kansas City School since 1999. And I'm excited to hear Chad's data update today because he first shared his data journey with us during our Capitol Hill briefing in October of 2018. So we have a really fabulous panel, lots of different kinds of data stories to share today. And without further ado, now I'll turn it over to Scott.
Well, thank you, Melinda. I don't know the other three panelists, but it was nice to see connections to all of them. To the gentlemen, it's great to have the same hairstyle. And to Sarah, a very good friend of Smithfield and lived in Rhode Island for 5 years. I'm very pleased to be here and support these efforts, Learning Forward and Bernstein Foundation, very important work. Out in New Jersey, we have been working in our school district on how we can best identify how direct professional development will impact learning. We all know it's a very challenge. I think we all probably lived through figuring out how to link the work we do to actual student growth and performance. What we've done here is we've taken the traditional observation model that is the New Jersey model, and we've made an alternative to it to focus specifically on reflective practice. And what we found is if we believe is if teachers own their own learning and own their own component of evaluation, we believe that's going to directly impact teacher growth, which will directly impact student growth and performance. Of course, very hard to track, but I'm going to share with you when I'm finished with this quick part about how we're planning to track and see where our progress is. What we're using to do this is every participant, teacher participant, will create what we're calling a problem of practice, which is something that the teachers care about that would make an impactful difference for student learning. So if you can see on this slide, basically these are the basic premises of where we're going with it. I've also included for you, I'm not going to read through them, but I've included two sample problems. And the reason I included these for you is we wanted to show you the shift when you take evaluation, which I don't think anyone ever says, yay, it's time for me to be observed, or I can't wait for my end of year evaluation meeting. What we're trying to do is shift that mindset. And to do that, we wanted teachers to own a critical area of their own performance that they believe, if improved, would directly impact their student learning. So the two problems I did share with you, one is about higher expectations and how a teacher wanted to focus their energy on how they could make sure they're balancing having high expectations, supporting the high expectations, and making sure they are building the scaffolding needed so that students meet them. We all are dealing with our own equity issues depending on where you are and what your equity issues are. We are definitely finding in our district that there are certain populations that are simply not performing. not new information for suburban New Jersey or probably suburban any state, and it's something we're directly targeting. What was so nice about this teacher's problem is they wanted to dedicate their year to figuring out and focusing on this. So what they do is they develop a problem. We tie in what New Jersey has is called a professional development plan for every teacher. We've combined the PDP along with their evaluation and made it one reflective model. So to show you a little bit about, if you can maybe move to the next slide and show them the other sample. This sample is a different example of the same kind of thinking, is how can my behavior, what can I do to shift? In this case, group work versus independent work, and the value of group work while still managing the value and measurement of individual work. Again, I think things we all struggle with, great strategies out there, but this teacher who values group work really wanted to focus their energy on that individual possible performance as well. So their focus, one of their focus questions, the bold, is what level of significant learning do you see for both groups and individuals? The next slide is just a really brief look. It's kind of hard to see on here, but how we measure it. And the issue with measuring evaluation, it's tricky. It's very hard to link in any one year a teacher's full performance to their student learning and growth. Yet we're going to show you how we're trying. In this particular model, what we're basically looking at is more about their reflective practice than their actual performance and how we combine the two. We're basing that on the quality research that exists on reflective practice, knowing that if teachers are focused continuously on reflective practice, that should have a very positive impact on student growth and learning. So again, this is a good document. Melinda, maybe we can put that out to people. And I would focus on the highly effective column in when growth is evident. I think one of our most compelling is on our next slide. And the most compelling piece of this, I'll say, are teachers' reactions. Again, our best hope is to turn evaluation into something that's not dreaded by both administrators and teachers. And so one common comment we hear is on the right-hand side, the second comment from the top. Although this was far more work than the traditional, I did not find this as extra work, but instead it enabled me to be more successful in designing and designs towards a goal. Just imagine, we have 135 teachers or 50% of our eligible staff who've made the decision to work harder on their own professional development than they would have if they just had the traditional model of evaluation. That's 50% of our teachers asking to be evaluated in a way that's more meaningful for them. So now what? Now what we want to know is this working? Does this matter, or is it just another really cool thing that makes people happy? So what we have in New Jersey, there's a program, a measurement tool called the SGP, the student growth percentile. That then converts to a teacher score. In other words, how does a child score on the standardized metrics of the state from 1 year over year? What they do is they simply take, let's say, a child that scored an 80 on a standardized assessment, and they take every other single child in the state that also scored an 80 or maybe close to an 80, and then they look at that child the next year. So it doesn't matter where you are in the district. They look at that growth percentile as compared to all the other students. We're using that data that exists for 3 or 4 years before we started this model to then see how it's affecting the people that are in it for 1 year, affecting it for 2 years, affecting it for 3 years. We're hoping to be able to isolate how reflective practice positively impacts students' learning and growth. It's not easy, it's complicated, but I would imagine we all face the same issue. Directly linking professional development and professional learning to student growth is a challenge, but the more and more I believe we work together and find out new and creative ways to get those measurements, the better we'll be able to identify what really works to manage, unfortunately, the funding, which is always a challenge for each of our districts. Thank you, Melinda.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Scott. I appreciate it. I'm encouraging people to put their questions for Scott and for all of the panelists in the chat box. We are going to go through the presentations and then come back to questions at the end, but thank you, Scott. So our next panelist is Sarah Monaco from Smithfield Public Schools in Rhode Island. Sarah?
Hi, good afternoon. As Melinda had mentioned, we have been a part of the What Matters Now network with Learning Forward, and you know, we were really looking at collaborative professional learning and hoping that it leads to improvement. So the context for us in our state, because there were three states involved with the What Matters Now network, but for Rhode Island, in 2018, we had just had new state requirements for professional learning units, PLUs, which are basically professional learning hours, which are now going to be tied to certification again. They had moved away from that for a few years, and we're moving back. The state also adapted professional learning standards, which really were more focused on collaborative time for teachers to really focus on curriculum implementation, because in Rhode Island, we have a new legislation that's calling for high quality curriculum by 2023. And we know that there has to be a significant amount of professional learning tied to that in order to implement properly. For us, when I came on board in 2017 here in Smithfield as the assistant superintendent, we did not have common writing assessments in K-5. They had moved away from those, so we were reinstituting them, and they were aligned to Common Core and to PARC assessment, and then now we have a new assessment, the Massachusetts assessment, MCAS. And we also had PD going on in Collins writing. So then our challenge on the next slide was basically, what can we do here? How can we provide additional high-quality job-embedded professional development that was relevant to our work in Smithfield? And the reality is that we didn't have more time, and we also didn't have more money. There's limited professional development time in our current contract. We have 2 days, which get eaten up very quickly, one in August, one in November. And then teachers have the opportunity to complete another 5.5 hours of approved professional learning, but that's done on their own, and there's limited collaboration with the other teachers. So then we looked and said, okay, well, what's our change idea here? Where do we have time? And we had faculty meetings, which were 1 hour a month, where the teachers were all together. We also had something called activity blocks. So again, in Rhode Island, you have to have recess, that's mandatory. So we had about 25 minutes a day where teachers were available to work together. Now, two of those get eaten up by duties, recess duty, whatnot. But then there are three others, 25 minutes each, that could be utilized for collaborative activities. So the question that we asked was, would the use of a student work analysis protocol impact instruction, which would then hopefully impact student achievement? And the student work analysis protocol is just a quick sort where teachers put the work into, and particularly writing. Of course, it had to do with our writing assessments, because the fear was we didn't just want them to be given and then graded. We wanted them to be utilized instructionally. So once those writing assessments were given, the teacher sorted them. That was definitely a quick sort, and the reason being we wanted them spending most of the time on determining what were the trends that we saw not only within the whole class but within those three groups, you know, the group that was not meeting expectations, meeting expectations and then exceeding, and you know, what were those trends so that we can figure out which instructional strategies we can utilize between the time the formative assessment was given and the time the summative assessment was given. To make growth, to have that growth occur with our students. And we did have many iterations of it. The whole point of What Matters Now is we're looking at short cycles of inquiry and short cycles of improvement, the Plan, Do, Study, Act. So we met with teachers a lot in regards to the protocol and how to make it easier, clearer, and more efficient. So, you know, how do we measure impact? So we measure impact by looking at the professional learning time. We know that we have 10 hours right there with faculty meetings that we are now utilizing in a much more focused way. The teachers began to understand the protocol and complete it without difficulty, and then we're able to do that as well in their activity blocks. We utilized educator surveys, and as Melinda said, she was absolutely right. It's important to give them right at the onset, because we were able to see that when we began this work in 2018, teachers reported looking at student work each trimester, and then by the time we administered it again this month, they reported looking at student work on a weekly basis. And again, they had kind of taken this protocol that they had used with writing and are now adopting it and using it for other subject areas. When asked if they utilized a protocol when looking at student work, most reported no back in 2018. And now in 2020, 90% of the teachers said that they were regularly using protocols. So another big piece of evidence was when we had the teachers share their instructional practices, both when looking at the protocols, but really just when having those really nice collegial conversations within faculty meetings and activity blocks. And we were able to monitor those and determine where we may need some professional development or where teachers kind of wanted more tools to figure out how to address some of the trends that they saw in the students' writing. And then, of course, you know, everyone always wants to look at the achievement scores, which can be really difficult because they're a lagging indicator, which, again, I can't stress enough the importance of having all of these other measures. But on our state test, which is the RICAS, they call it the RICAS, it's really just the Massachusetts test that we purchased here in Rhode Island. But when we compared our district to all the other districts in Rhode Island, in grade 3 in writing, we ranked 4th. In grade 4, we ranked 1st. And in grade 5, we ranked 2nd. And I think if the writing, language, and reading scores had been more consistent, I wouldn't have thought as much of that, you know, if we were equally high in all those areas. But as you can see, our writing scores were significantly higher rank-wise than reading. In addition, on that next slide, and I know Scott just spoke about this a little bit, he talked about the SGPs, the student growth percentiles. If you look all the way at the bottom, that's the state distribution. So you can see, you know, about 31% of students have high growth, 35% typical growth, 35% low growth. That's how they norm everyone else. Our two participating schools in the What Matters Now network, one of them is right at the top, Anna McCabe. We had 53% of students achieving high growth, 41% typical growth, and only 6% with low growth. And then our other participating school, La Perche School, they had 63% of students with high growth, 25% with typical growth, and 12% with low growth. So we've been very excited about all of these results and hope that they continue.
Awesome. Thank you, Sarah. Appreciate it so much. We're going to go on to Godfrey Rangasamy, our other What Matters Now data expert. Godfrey, take it away.
Thank you, Melinda and Sarah. Good afternoon, everyone. We, Prince George's County Public Schools, is part of the What Matters Now network, too. Like Sarah mentioned, there are 3 states: Rhode Island, Ohio, and Maryland. So I'm going to focus on Prince George's County Public Schools. As you can see from the first slide, it's a huge collaboration between University of Maryland, Learning Forward, the state, and the district. So the whole notion, as Sarah mentioned, we are using improvement science research as the basis of our problem of practice to improve the teaching and learning of the new standards, next generation science standards. So what are some challenges? As you can see from the slide, in 2013, the state adopted a new set of standards, next generation science standards, and that required teachers shift their thinking, their pedagogy, and their vision of how to teach science, K through 12. Next was an adoption of a state assessment titled Maryland Integrated Science Assessment statewide, and is administered in grades 5, 8, and high school. Under the ESSA, I was mentioned earlier, the Maryland Integrated Science Assessment scores now count towards overall school performance. In 2017-2018, in support of the new standards, internally, we engaged an external vendor to audit our curricula in grades 3 through 8 in high school biology. And was sort of expected that it was not highly aligned to next gen, hence the need for this intervention. In 2018-2019, we joined the What Matters Now School Network, and what we saw, well, let me rephrase that. The pilot schools that we chose demonstrated scores that were, you know, promising compared to the states, as you can see, 5% below the state, the district, and 30% average below the state. So the notion here was, how do we address teachers' capacity in terms of providing high-quality professional learning opportunities that's grounded in curricular instructional materials to support these shifts of the new standard? So as you can see, we are a very large urban and suburban district, over 208 schools, quite a few elementary schools, middle and high schools. I'm going to focus on our two pilot schools. The first one, Benjamin Stoddard, as you can see, is a smaller enrollment school, primarily 82% African-American students, whereas Buck Lodge Middle, very large school, and 86% Hispanic students. So we have some varying demographics here. So what was the intervention? So as I said, we joined the network in 2018. The change idea was a collaborative effort of several stakeholders, and the idea centered around some common self-assessment processes with common tools for teachers to examine and reflect on their implementation of next-gen aligned lessons and to share observations with their colleagues in a structured professional learning setting. So internally, we had to develop our own tools to coincide with our problem of practice. For example, how do we know that our lessons are next gen aligned? So we had to create an internal lesson checklist to next gen using documents like the EQIP rubric and the PEEP rubric and inputs from the state and other partners. So we distributed the whole notion of the problem of practice, leadership from principal, central office, and the State Department of Education to include University of Maryland. Through several iterations, evolving iterations, and for continuous learning and improvement of science in the classroom, we guided the teachers' practice towards how can we effectively, in these two schools, inform policy around professional learning opportunities. So what came then was a 3PLC protocol supported by several tools that focus on high-quality professional learning experiences that are grounded in high-quality curricular instructional materials. So we use, to begin with, like the first set of cycle, we use already vetted next-gen aligned documents. For example, the Open SciEd documents that were vetted through the EQIP rubric and ACHIEVE. So that was a challenge. How do we know it was next-gen aligned? Hence, we had to tweak and revise our tools. So what did we see in terms of an impact? So I'm gonna talk primarily about Benjamin Stoddard because they started in 2018, as you saw in a previous slide, and Buck Lodge started last year, 2019. So what we found out through these iterations of the PDSA cycles, 75% of our teachers agreed or strongly disagreed that participating in these PLC series improved their knowledge of next gen. 88% agreed or strongly agreed that the PLCs helped them to better understand what instructional resources were needed. As I said earlier, the new set of standards next gen demands that teachers teach using all three dimensions, the practices, the cross-cutting concepts, and the content to deliver daily instruction. So, and that was a challenge. So Benjamin Stoddard also reconfigured their master schedule to protect their quality PLC time that centered around teachers' discussion of lessons they have reviewed and student work samples. So I had the opportunity of interacting with some of these teachers, and the conversation evolve from sharing information to learning about information and best practices for teaching and learning of next gen. It's pretty cool stuff. Oakridge, the culture there was that teachers during their PLC time, they were not focusing primarily on teaching and learning of science. They were sharing ideas, sharing routine practices. Once they started to engage with what matters now, network, the structure changed to revising lesson plans to 3D teaching and learning. From a collaborative planning shifted to a collaborative learning. So teachers actually bought in and they were students of the whole notion of pedagogy around next gen. More significantly, our current superintendent incorporated the PDSA cycle, the whole notion of improvement science as a systemic initiative. So that's captured in our coherence framework, and moving forward, it will be one of the pieces that would drive several other opportunities across content in the district. So what's next? I know we have a lot of data to crunch. The first one, of course, is how will our pilot schools perform compared to last year's MESA scores? And there are several teacher practice shifts that we will be analyzing, as you can see, things like the agenda, the discourse, engagement, and of course, self-reporting from the teacher surveys.
Awesome. Thank you, Godfrey.
You're welcome.
And Chad, can we turn it over to you to talk about North Kansas City Schools?
All right, so good afternoon, everybody, from the home, of course, of your Super Bowl champions, Kansas City Chiefs. It's been a lot of fun around here lately over the past couple of weeks. Had our first red snow day ever, which the entire city shut down for a day to celebrate the Chiefs and the parade. So lots of excitement out here. But to tell you a little bit about our story, really started in 2010, and I would best describe North Kansas City Schools as a system of schools in which we had 21 elementary schools that approached reading and writing instruction in more than 21 different ways. We had multiple models within each school, sometimes different levels, different grade levels approached it in different ways. We had different amounts of time allocated to reading and writing across all of our elementary schools. And as a result of being a system of really independent schools, our academic achievement was impacted. We had a significant number of students reading below grade level. As we looked at our state achievement data, state achievement data in comparison to peer districts, and just in comparison to the state of Missouri, we were below, and we were below for a number of years. All population and all groups of students, our achievement gaps were large. We had a lot of challenges. And so in 2010, we brought together a literacy task force, and we studied the research on reading and writing for about a year and a half. And so our solution to addressing this problem on this slide right here, was developing a district-wide literacy plan. And as a school district, we've never had a district-wide plan for just our elementary schools. Now, we have since taken that plan and have extended it through our senior year now all the way through high school, but at that time we didn't have anything even at the elementary level, which arguably is the most important thing that we do, is teach kids how to read and write. So really our approach to this problem and our solution was a multi-pronged approach to professional development, one of those being the implementation of demonstration classrooms. And so demonstration classrooms are teachers that have a high alignment of instructional practice to research, and what research really shows improves reading and writing outcomes for students. And so we originally only had about 3 or 4 demonstration classrooms when we actually began implementing our literacy plan in 2012, but that has grown to probably over 15 right now. And with our demonstration classroom teachers, we require 50% of all of our elementary teachers in all of our elementary schools to attend at least one demonstration classroom throughout the course of the year. So we have a significant number of teachers that are out there with peer observations and visiting these demonstration classrooms. And that's been a significant part of our sustainability in this model, is having those demonstration teachers as leaders. Consultant work specific to grade level. As we rolled out this district-wide plan, we partnered with Debbie Miller and Ellen Keene and Matt Glover and some of those other consultants that that are really, really strong in connecting practice to research. And we had grade level teams that came together about 3 or 4 times throughout the school year, and were able to not just learn from them, but also to go into classrooms and see them in action and really develop an understanding of how research and practice really come together and what that looks like. We spent a significant amount of time with our principals and instructional coaches with professional development. We transformed all of our elementary principal meetings into professional development, and we still do that today. We don't spend a lot of time on business, a little bit in our elementary principal meetings, but most of it is all focused on adult learning. And, you know, at that time, the first few years as we were implementing this model, it was, of course, all focused on reading and writing, professional development, and leadership for our principals and coaches. And we've since transformed that a little bit, but we spent a significant amount of time building their capacity with the belief that those leading our buildings and responsible for implementing this plan have to be knowledgeable. They have to know what to look for. They have to be able to support teachers, have to be able to provide good feedback. And so we spent a significant amount of time and invested in them and their professional learning. And then we have monthly professional development for all of our K-5 teachers. We still have this in place today. Again, for the first several years when we implemented this model, it was all focused on reading and writing. But what we did is through the use of our elementary principal meetings, and then knowing that every elementary school has at least one staff meeting for 1 hour every month, we worked with our principals and we all came to consensus to take and develop a module, a 1 hour module or professional development session that we would roll out to our principals at our principal meetings, and then our principals would roll out to their staff once a month. And so we have a model in North Kansas City now where we have common professional development in all 22 elementary schools now. We've added one since every 4 weeks. So we're able to get out to all of our teachers every 4 weeks, which has been significant in terms of being able to develop common language, common ground, common practices across all of our schools throughout the district. So to give you an idea of just impact, and what this has done, you can see here in 2013, and I can go back to 2000, 2010, 2006, you would see the same pattern. We were performing below the state in every single grade level every single year. It was very rare for us to see performance above the state, and if we did, it was typically luck because we didn't have really an intentional plan as a school district to improve some of those outcomes. So, as you move into the next slide, then you can see from 2013 and then 2018 and 19 that we are continuing to perform above the state across the board. In all grade levels, our middle school, now that we're in our third year of implementing our model at the middle school level, we're beginning to see results there as well, with all of our middle school grade levels performing at or above the state, and they have now for the last 2 consecutive years. And again, that wasn't something that we always saw. And we had a different state assessment in 2017 and 16. I think we've had 3 or 4 different state assessments in the last 5 or 6 years in Missouri, so that's been kind of a challenge. However, now that we've been through 3 different state assessments, our results are staying very consistent in terms of our performance above the state and any other school district that looks and mirrors our demographics and size in Missouri, we significantly outperform as well. And so we're still on this journey where, like I said, the actual first year of implementation was in 2012, so we're about 9 years in and still holding strong, and this is our first year with implementing a literacy model at the high school level. But that was a big challenge for us is, you know, we do all this work and we get it going at the elementary level, and then we create the model at the middle school level, but then when students were going to high school, it could look very, very different, and the volume of reading and writing began to drastically decrease, and we had to develop a model and a plan to change that trajectory for kids. And so we're still learning, we're still growing, and still have lots of work to do, but it's been a journey, and we're excited about where we're at.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Chad. So you've heard four great data summaries, and if I could have everybody clap and unmute you to clap for them, I would, but I know you all are sending positive thoughts, and we started seeing some people asking for some of the documents. We will send out, Ariel posted a PDF of the slides in the chat box already, but we will also send it out along with a recording of the webinar to everybody. But I really limited the panelists to one data story. And so one of the questions I would have is that if there are other types of data that you are collecting on a constant basis, we always try and talk about there's lots of kinds of data. Do any of you all have some other types of data that you collect, and how do you use that data? Anybody want to jump in?
This is Chad. Another piece of data that we use is just surveys to our teachers after every professional development session. We want to know, is the professional development that we are providing, is it aligned to the district model of instruction? We ask the question, is there anything in this professional development that you think you can't use? Maybe there's some barriers that exist that make it difficult to be able to actually implement the professional development. So we're always asking questions and creating surveys that have a lot to do with alignment. That's with professional development, sometimes it's important to have that support and that professional development aligned to what the expectations are of the school district and of classroom teachers. And so we work really hard on getting that feedback from our teachers to ensure that what we're providing them is aligned to what's expected of them as well.
Chad, do you encourage your leaders that work with you? You mentioned the principal work that you do. Do you encourage them to do similar sorts of surveys? And do you all ever look at both survey data and feedback together to sort of influence your next sessions?
We do. We're able to collect district-wide data and building-by-building data. And then a part of our conferences that myself and Kristen Havens, who directly oversees our elementary schools now, that's part of the data that we sit down and look at that with them during their evaluation conferences, just to get a sense of, the professional development, not just that we're providing as a district, but also the building level professional development that's being provided, because we do have an early release every week, a 30-minute early release on Thursdays. So that's a really, really important time for our teachers and our principals, because we're sending kids home away from their teachers and away from instruction and committing this time to adult learning. And so that's a really good piece of data for us, and it's a big part of our conversations and what we look at as we plan and make changes to professional learning throughout the course of the year.
Awesome. Sarah or Godfrey or Scott, do you all want to mention any other types of data that you collect?
Yeah, this is Sarah. Monica, I just wanted to mention that we've started using walkthrough data. We do walkthroughs once per trimester in each classroom, and what we're looking for there are the actual changes to instructional practice, and we have the principals obviously are the ones who do those, but I've calibrated with them to make sure we're looking for the same sorts of things. Teachers are very aware of the tool and aware that it's not evaluative at all. What we happen to be looking at is actually math implementation with those, but we're able to put everything into Google Forms so that we have graphic representations of the data and can look at change over time.
In addition, we use a peer collaboration tool where teachers have a tool that they pre-visit, during the visit, and after the visit, share information to the observer, an observee of their findings. And then we capture that in a survey tool.
This is Scott.
Scott?
Yeah, what we're trying to look at, and we're having a hard time quantifying,
is motivation. So within the reflective practice model, we built a submodel of motivation where we're trying to actually identify, using research methods, exactly what motivation we see, and is that linking to something different in our staff, eventually, again, linking to something different in performance with our students. It is a struggle to do this, but we're working on it. The only other area that we're using in this particular area is related to anecdotal data, surveys from students, surveys from staff, and comparisons between people that are in the module and people who are not.
Awesome. And Scott, I'm guessing that you would welcome if anybody else has developed any surveys or data collection tools around motivation, that you would love to know about those. So I would encourage anybody that has them to go ahead and put those in the chat box, sir, so that Scott can find you as well and all of the panelists.
I agree. Thanks so much.
I'm going to ask Ariel, who I want to thank for helping lead us through the technology today, to leave the chat box open for a few minutes. There are a couple of questions, and I'm hoping that the questions from our panelists might be able to take a few minutes and make sure you're able to connect with the people that have specific questions. Before you go, I do have a huge favor, and that is that I put a link in the chat box to our Pepsi petition. This is a petition that we are going to deliver to Capitol Hill at the end of April. It calls on decision makers at the school building, district level, state level, province level, and the federal level to include an annual increase for professional learning in their budgets year over year. And so if you could take literally about 30 seconds to sign the petition and then to share it with others in your network, we would so appreciate it. I mentioned that we're going to do our next Capitol Hill briefing on April 29th, so watch for more information about that. As we always do, we will live stream it so that those of you that aren't here in DC are able to join in the conversation online. And finally, our advocacy pages are at learningforward.org/advocacy. There you can join the A-Team. It's a fairly painless club to be a member of. It's really keeping you up to date on what's happening both at the federal level and in other data impact and evidence conversations. So please sign up today. With that, I'm going to say goodbye and thank you so much to the panelists. You all did a wonderful job. We're so appreciative of you sharing the data that you're collecting and the impact that it's making in your districts. And we look forward to continuing to hear about your data journey as you move forward. And again, thank you. If you can leave the chat box open just for a few minutes, and then we will close out in about 5 minutes. So thanks everybody for joining us today.